It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where the temperature has climbed all the way up to 22 degrees under increasingly overcast skies. At the airport, they have completely calm winds and 10 full miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly sunny skies for today and tomorrow, with partly cloudy skies overnight. Highs near 29 today, overnight low about 20, high near 27 tomorrow. West winds to 10 or so, maybe to 20 tonight, turning to the northwest tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, Kodiak has been chilly. The head teacher in Port Lions is urging maintenance at the school there. And a proposal to revamp the retirement system for Alaska state and local government employees is scheduled for debate in the Senate this week. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Big tech executives are under more pressure to better protect underage users from online dangers. That was evident today on Capitol Hill, where the heads of several major companies face anger from lawmakers and, in the audience, parents. Republican Josh Hawley of Missouri sparred with Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, asking him if he had apologized to directly affected families, including those in the room.
Would you like to apologize for what you've done to these good people?
Zuckerberg then stood, turned around, and faced the family, apologizing to them. In this exchange with Republican Senator Tom Cotton, TikTok CEO Shuji Chu disputed allegations that the popular social media platform helps China spy on U.S. interests.
You will find content that is critical of China on our platform.
The next time you go on, are you scared that you'll be arrested and disappear the next time you go to mainland China?
Senator, you will find content that's critical of China and any other country freely on TikTok.
Okay.
Executives, including those from X, Snap, and Discord, face similar questioning from Democrats on the Judiciary Committee. Well, the FBI says it completed an operation to disrupt Chinese hackers that had broken into U.S. critical infrastructure. Intelligence officials came together to warn lawmakers about the severity of the threat. Here's NPR's Jenna McLaughlin.
Last year, the U.S. government revealed that a Chinese hacking group called Volt Typhoon had broken into U.S. critical infrastructure in Guam. That way, in the event China invaded Taiwan, for example, hackers would try to disrupt a U.S. military response. FBI Director Christopher Wray said the FBI broke into a large number of routers compromised by Chinese hackers to kick them out.
The FBI ran a court-authorized on-network operation to shut down Volt Typhoon and the access it enabled.
While the operation was successful, Wray says it is just the tip of the iceberg. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
Well, as expected, the Federal Reserve opted not to change interest rates, and markets ended the day lower. NPR's David Gurr reports there was a sharp decline after the Fed's chair announced it is not the most likely case the Fed will cut interest rates at its next meeting in March.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said there's a ways to go to achieve a so-called soft landing. The Fed is trying to get inflation under control without triggering a recession. Powell acknowledged the strength of recent economic data, but he told reporters at a news conference following the Fed's decision he and his colleagues want to see more. Fed policymakers said they want to have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%, which is the Fed's target. Stocks and bond yields fell on comments from Powell. He doesn't expect the Fed will be ready to cut interest rates at its next meeting in March. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
The Dow closed down 317 points. The S&P was down 79, or more than 1.5%. This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Kodiak temperatures dropped into the single digits over the past few days, with a low of 1 degree below zero yesterday. Although these are the coldest temperatures so far this season, meteorologists say this is not out of the ordinary for Kodiak Island winters. Climatologist Rick Toman with the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy says the last 2 days of January dropped below zero in Kodiak.
The last time that we had 2 days in a winter in Kodiak with temperatures at or below zero was in 2019-20, so don't have to go back too far to find that.
Climate data for at least part of Kodiak Island has been recorded for more than 100 years, but Toman says the historical record has gaps of several years and is inconsistent in terms of where the data was gathered, how far away the location was from the water, and things like that. All that said, Kodiak Island has not seen a record low temperature in over 30 years.
The record low temperature in Kodiak is 16 below, and that was recorded in January 1989, super cold late January all across the state.
It seems during the rest of the week, the city of Kodiak hits the tail end of the current cold snap, though. The forecast calls for high temperatures in the 20s. For the rest of the communities on the island, Port Lyons, Uzinki, Larson Bay, and the like, there's a slight chance of snow, which could turn into rain later this week, going on into the weekend.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way. 486-4782.
The head teacher in Port Lyons urged the Kodiak Island Borough School District to address several maintenance issues during the district's Board of Education meeting last week. KMXT's Brian Venois reports.
The Port Lyons School has just two teachers. Shayla Deming handles the primary education, and her partner, Ken Stockard, handles secondary education. Deming says they currently serve about 19 students between them. She says while teaching, the curriculum has been going well. She's concerned about the condition of the school. She says one of the staff's immediate concerns is the lack of hot water in the showers.
Our showers don't have hot water. Both sinks do in the bathrooms, but the showers do not. And so maintenance is aware of that, and they're going to try to fix that before May.
The school's showers are primarily used by visitors like maintenance staff. Deming says the staff are also concerned about the Port Lyons School flooring. Old laminate has been, quote, ripping and cracking.
And about every day, probably twice or three times a day, we'll see someone trip, especially me when I'm not looking. We slide across that and trip on it. So it's kind of becoming a safety hazard.
She ended the maintenance section of her presentation by describing the condition of the school's exterior as rotting in some sections and in need of repainting. One of the longstanding maintenance concerns, however, is handling the remnants of a colony of bats living in the school building's attic. Peggy Azuyak is the district's principal of rural schools. She says the bats have already left the facility and maintenance just needs to finish sealing all of the areas of the building to prevent future infestations.
We did an air quality study in the summer in order to make sure that it's not something that would affect our students or our staff in the building. So, it was just to get a head start on the mitigation work, and then they'll do more work this spring to really make it bat-proof.
Azuyak says staff have regular upkeep plans to ensure the Port Lyons facility stays bat-free for the foreseeable future. The district has plans to dispatch maintenance staff to the rural school in the coming months. The school district also plans to present an initial draft of the budget at its next meeting on Monday. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the Alaska State Capitol on Monday to call for an increase in education funding, as reported by Alaska Public Media. The rally was supposed to come just before Governor Mike Dunleavy's State of the State address, which wound up being delayed by a day due to poor weather. Here's what Rebecca Braun, parent of a 16-year-old, wanted to hear from the governor.
If we value the next generation, we must invest in their education. That's why I, Governor Dunleavy, am introducing a bill to raise the base student allocation by $1,400. This amount begins to make up for the substantial bite inflation has taken over the last decade.
The BSA has risen just a 0.5% since 2017. The House's Republican-led majority so far has offered a bill with a $300 increase. A parade of Democratic and independent lawmakers took the mic, each demanding a significant increase to the base student allocation.
Important programs that support student engagement are facing cuts, things like arts and music, cultural programs, special education, PE, and athletics. In the prosperous state of Alaska, we can do better. We can do better. We must do better.
High school junior Carson Carley says he wants to go into engineering, architecture, or finance in college, but he says many prerequisites are no longer offered at local schools.
And I'm going to have to figure out a way to do that online through a college or drive out to UAS or something to get that class in before I go to college, because that's what I'm passionate about. And that's something that can be solved by the raising the BSA.
Senate leaders said Tuesday they are in negotiations with their House counterparts on the pending education bill. Governor Mike Dunleavy implored Alaskans and lawmakers to capitalize on the state's natural resources in his annual State of the State address on Tuesday. During the 50-minute address to the legislature, he said resource development projects like the Red Dog Mine, where his daughters work, had transformed rural communities. But he said changing attitudes toward development threaten Alaska's economic future.
Too many in our great state have gotten very good at saying no. No to opportunities for other Alaskans, based on a false premise that one person's opportunity is somehow another person's liability.
Much of Dunleavy's speech focused on education. It's a topic leaders from the House and Senate have listed among their top priorities for the session. Senate leadership has called for a large increase in state funding, as much as $1,000 more per student. Meanwhile, the House has countered with a $300 per student increase, along with a variety of reforms. Dunleavy has threatened to veto any bill that increases per student funding without other education reforms. In Tuesday's address, he pushed to expand Alaska's public charter schools, which would get a boost in the House education bill.
It's not about money. It's not about a student's background that determines how well one does. It's about the environment, connecting with students, building relationships, and valuing the individual. With the right environment and the right approach to learning, our students can succeed beyond our wildest dreams.
But the bill has to make it through both chambers first. And in response to Dunleavy's speech, Senate President Gary Stevens said he has serious concerns about the House's education reform package.
It started out as a very simple bill. So much has been added to it. Things that we, many of us can't quite agree to. I appreciate the governor's approach. I'm not sure that, for example, whether a bonus is the right way to give a salary increase, or whether it's best to work through our school districts who have that responsibility and to give that money through the BSA.
During the speech, Dunleavy honored a state trooper, a charter school principal, a teacher, Wrangell Mayor Patty Gilbert, a farmer, and the manager of a Subway restaurant in Anchorage, where Dunleavy said he frequently has lunch. A proposal to revamp the retirement system for Alaska state and local government employees is scheduled for debate in the state Senate this week. The bill would move Alaska's public employees back to a pension system, which would be a big change from the current 401k-style plan. Here's Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone in Juneau.
So this is all about the retirement system for government employees, both state and local. So if you work for an employer who participates in the Public Employees Retirement System, called PERS, or you're a teacher with access to the Teachers Retirement System, called TERS, this bill would affect you. Right now, most public employees in Alaska, as you mentioned, have a 401k-style retirement account. It's what finance people call a defined contribution system. And basically, you and your employer both put some money aside in an account, and then it grows over time. But the catch is that if the stock market crashes, you're the one left holding the bag. You're the one taking the risk. So, like, if you wanted to retire in 2008 or when markets dipped in 2018, you might have had to wait a little bit longer for the markets to recover. So what this bill would do is move to a pension system. Instead of definite contributions from the employer, like the 401k system, what's guaranteed is the level of benefits. It's a defined benefit plan. So instead of you taking the risk of a market downturn or making the wrong choices of investments, the state takes that risk. And it's meant to address a couple of things. There's high vacancies in state jobs, and then there's also the state's declining population. Here's Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican, making the pitch.
The population that we're predominantly losing is the age 18 to 64, working age group, right? We know that there is a serious shortage of teachers. We are watching our police officers and firefighters walk out the door to other states with all the training after 5 years.
And people who currently have the 401k-style plan would be allowed to transition to the pension plan if this passes.
So it sounds like the state would take on that risk and it'd be better for employees. But let's back up. How did the state end up with the system it currently has?
So basically from statehood, it's not precisely, but basically from statehood, there was a pension system for state workers. Now, the state got some bad actuarial advice down the line, and that led to underfunding, and that wound up putting the state billions in the hole. And the state still has something like $4 billion in unfunded pension liability from the old system. One assumption that didn't work out, people lived a lot longer, and that naturally costs a lot more when you're covering, you know, retired people. So in 2006, the legislature passed a bill creating the current 401k-style system, sometimes called Tier 4. But ever since, lawmakers have been trying to get the state back to the pension system. There's been a bill in every legislature since 2007 to restore the pension system.
I mean, it just sounds like a cost issue, right?
That's right. We're at least making sure that we don't end up billions underwater again.
Right. Well, Eric, what is the price tag then?
So it's not entirely clear. There are at least two different analyses of this out there. One of them is by an actuary working for the Senate Finance Committee. It says it basically comes out in the wash. It's more or less what the state currently pays for the defined contribution system. Another by an actuary hired by the Department of Administration, which runs the retirement program, found that it would cost the state something like $1.2 billion over 16 years.
Okay. I mean, that's a pretty big gap. What's up with that?
So here's the thing. The bigger number, the $1.2 billion number, that sort of assumes the bill works, so to speak, right? As I said, one of the big goals with this bill is to make it easier to fill government jobs. Not everybody buys that. More on that in a sec, but that's the goal. The analysis puts the cost at $1.2 billion. That assumes the state manages to grow its annual payroll spending by $250 million, basically by retaining people. Of course, open jobs have their own cost. You have to pay bonuses to attract people. Maybe you give folks overtime. Then there's, you know, also a cost to the whole economy when the state doesn't provide the services it usually does. Think of the food stamp crisis, for example. And another big thing financially that is, you know, meant to protect the state from going underwater again is health benefits would stay the same as they currently are for folks on the 401k style Tier 4 plan. Some older pension systems had very different health benefit systems that were quite a bit more expensive.
Gotcha. Well, how do we know this is going to improve hiring and retention, those teachers and police officers and firefighters that Kathy Geisel is talking about?
So the short answer is we kind of don't. You know, there's some evidence suggesting it might. There's the actuary hired by the Senate Finance Committee I mentioned earlier. His name is Gene Kowarski. He said a pension system is especially important for retaining mid-career teachers, police officers, and other public safety workers.
When these people reach mid-career, they start worrying about retirement. And it's awfully difficult to keep these people if they can flip over to the lower 40 eight states and find a pension, a defined benefit pension.
But of course, you can't see the future, and there are certainly some skeptical folks out there. I mean, obviously, there are other states out there with pension plans, and they're also having a lot of trouble filling jobs. Senator Bert Stedman, he's a Sitka Republican on the Finance Committee. He spoke to this.
If this is being targeted as the answer to recruitment and retention, why do all the other states with defined benefit plans have retention and recruitment issues? It doesn't line up. There's something else going on other than retirement.
All right, Eric, where do things go from here?
So the bill is scheduled for debate in the state Senate Wednesday. It's likely to get a couple of amendments, sort of making some minor tweaks, but it has 11 Senate co-sponsors, so it is likely to pass. But it faces an uphill battle in the mostly Republican-controlled House. Geisel told me today that negotiations with the House haven't really started in earnest, so you'll have to stay tuned.
That was Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone discussing the state pension bill working its way through the Senate this week. A group of scientists from the University of Washington conducted a string of experiments in Homer this winter to better understand how fiber optic cables could be used to detect seismic activity. The hope is the results could lead to improved early warning systems. KDLL's Hunter Morrison has more on the experiment.
Underwater fiber optic cables span the globe, providing telecommunication services in the blink of an eye. They transmit photons of light from one side to another, which are sometimes reflected back. Scientists have found the returning photons can be used to measure passing acoustic and seismic waves, as well as other small stresses, which can help provide a picture of earthquake activity. Through a process known as distributed acoustic sensing, scientists have experimented with optic cables to measure seismic activity for about a decade. Brad Lepofsky is an assistant professor at the University of Washington. He and a team of scientists began conducting research with Cook Inlet's fiber optic cables last summer.
We can observe marine mammals that make, you know, acoustic vocalizations. They talk to each other. We can also observe the seismic waves from earthquakes that pass through the area.
The team is sampling fibers from two cable routes belonging to telecommunications company GCI, one that stretches across Cook Inlet from Homer and another that runs from Homer to Kenai. The company leased the team idle fibers within the cable network.
They're leasing us this cable just because they think it's going to be helpful that we could possibly use this to provide better warnings for earthquakes, or at least, at the very least, to better understand the hazard, to understand when and where and how and why the earthquakes happen where they do.
Lepofsky says the fiber optic cables have allowed the team to observe waves that echo off of converging seismic plates with higher precision. He says they can detect these waves at a distance of up to 200 kilometers, about 125 miles.
Seismologists have known about these for a long time. They're not particularly like a new thing to science. However, when you can see them with as much resolution as we have, then you really can just see a lot more stuff going on.
And if these cables can be used for scientific measurements and arrays, it's just a massive amount of data that could be used by not only geophysicists, but their biologists are picking up, whales and other marine creatures.
This is Bruce Ryan, principal engineer at GCI.
It seems to be a technology that could be huge because of the massive amount of cables that are out in the ocean that could literally become, scientific arrays for collecting data.
While states like California have early warning systems when it comes to detecting earthquakes, Lepofsky says their biggest difficulty is recognizing seismic activity offshore. Currently, the most widely used technology to detect earthquakes is seismometers.
With the fiber, we already have the sensors out there. The fiber acts as a sensor itself. And so if we can use these systems, it would really help with the offshore seismicity.
Lepofsky says distributed acoustic sensing can warn people roughly 10 seconds before an earthquake hits. Because it's a relatively new technology, no governments have implemented it into their current earthquake detection systems. The University of Washington team plans to continue their research this spring. In Kenai, I'm Hunter Morrison.
The cost of employing an employee is moderating a bit. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute. The Labor Department's Employment Cost Index, measuring pay and benefits, rose 0.9% in the 3 months ending in December. That's a modest slowdown from the previous quarter and is more evidence suggesting inflation might decrease in the near future. That could encourage Federal Reserve officials to cut interest rates. Boeing lost $30 million in its last quarter, and that's before a panel blowout of a MAX 9 jet operated by Alaska Airlines earlier this month. The company today did not update its financial guidance as it deals with continuing fallout. A Delaware judge rescinded a $56 billion compensation agreement between Tesla and Elon Musk, calling it excessive. The unusual ruling could be appealed. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is Swedish Friday, the 31st day of January, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 9:14. It will set again promptly at 5:32, giving us 8 hours and 18 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 22 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 50 degrees, set in 1963, and our record low was minus 5, set in 1999. Currently 22 degrees under overcast skies. It feels a lot warmer. Completely calm winds at the airport and visibility of 10 miles. Mostly sunny skies are called for this afternoon with a high near 29, west winds to 10, gusting to 20. Partly cloudy skies overnight and mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Overnight low of 20, high near 27 tomorrow. West winds to 20 tonight, turning to the northwest tomorrow. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide will be at 5:01 p.m. and be 6 2/3 feet here on the east side, followed by a low tide at 11:05 p.m. of 1.4 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:35 p.m. and be 11.3 feet, followed by a low tide at 11:37 p.m. of 2.3 feet in Larsen Bay. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, out to 15 nautical miles. Variable 10, becoming northwest 20 this afternoon, 5-foot seas today and tonight. West 20 tonight, turning to northwest 20 tomorrow with 5-foot seas again. But look for freezing spray tomorrow on our east side. Over in the Shelikof Strait, southwest 15 and seas to 3 feet. Becoming west 20 tonight and seas to 4 feet. Northwest 20 tomorrow with 4-foot seas and freezing spray tomorrow in the Shelikof as well. Today's the day. Come by the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center tonight at 6 p.m. for a presentation by Bill Pyle and to congratulate him on his retirement. Bill will be discussing what refuge staff have learned about Kodiak bears over the course of his more than 20-year-long career as a senior wildlife biologist. Sounds like a lot of fun. That's at 6 p.m. at the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center tonight. Tomorrow, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers. That will be happening at 6:30 p.m. And the Kodiak City Council will be holding a strategic planning work session on Friday. That will begin at 9 a.m. and be held at the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center conference room over on Near Island, rather than the library. This meeting is open to the public, and it will be web-streamed. The web streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you need meeting materials or have questions, contact the clerk's office at 907-486-8636. But again, that starts 9 a.m. Friday morning. Also tonight, at the library, Traveler's Destination featuring Roy and Crystal Thomas. And they're going to talk about and show pictures of their journey to Tanzania and Mount Kilimanjaro. Come learn about their hikes and view their images of beautiful vistas. Again, that's 6:30 p.m. tonight at the Public Library. And Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. is always the Lego Club. Children under 10 must be accompanied by an adult. Thursdays at 10:30 a.m. is preschool story time. That's for kids 3 to 6. And Thursday at 3 p.m. is the next chess club gathering. Drop in to learn, practice, or sharpen your skills in a cozy, friendly environment. No experience is necessary, and chess club is open for all ages. Again, that's Thursday at 3 p.m. And Canna's Elder Storytime is Friday, February 2nd. That's happening at 10:30 p.m. No, a.m., of course. Also, Disney's Beauty and the Beast will be shown on Friday at the library. That's happening at 3:30 p.m. Runtime is about 84 minutes. Beauty and the Beast, Friday at 3:30 p.m. at the library. The Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District is calling all Kodiak's agricultural enthusiasts, including chicken farmers, ranchers, growers, gardeners, everybody. They are going to have a talk on Thursday, that's tomorrow, about the challenges of agriculture in Kodiak and the solutions people have developed. They will also discuss potential future workshops that might be helpful, and there will be a brief introduction to programs already available to assist agriculture producers in Kodiak. That's all happening at the Kodiak Public Library on Thursday, tomorrow from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. and drop in whenever you can during that time. And The Outsiders is coming this weekend. KMS Drama Club presents the teen drama adapted by Christopher Sergel from the book by S.E. Hinton. That's happening Friday and Saturday, 7 p.m. at the Drama Pod. $3 for students and $5 for adults. Seniors, $3 too. That's at the Gerald C. Drama Pod, 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Also, Friday is the first Friday Art Walk. The Frame Shop, the Islander Bookshop, the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center, Kodiak History Museum, and the Aleutic Museum and Store will all have fun exhibits to view.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.